For decades, the patriots of Eastern Europe fought against communism. Despite the threat of imprisonment and near total censorship, they continued to speak out. They called themselves dissidents. Ultimately, they prevailed against tremendous odds. Now, at long last, American patriots are speaking out against the forces that are destroying this country. This program is the voice of those patriots. This is American Dissident Voices. Your host is Kevin Alfred Strom.
Thank you, Richard Cotton. Today we conclude our series entitled The History and Significance of the New World Order. Today's program is part 5 in this series, written by researcher and writer Scott Spencer of Toronto, Ontario, Canada. On our last program, we looked at the common Jewish roots of abolitionism, Illuminism, and the various 19th century revolutionary doctrines of equality. Let us begin today's program by examining one of the most pernicious Jewish doctrines of all time, Marxism. Marxism, Illuminism Reincarnate. Karl Marx, though he disclaimed the Jewish religion, was a descendant of a long line of rabbis. Both his father and mother were Jews. His father, Heinrich, a well-to-do lawyer who was a dutiful follower of the Enlightenment philosophers, was faced with a choice of being baptized or giving up his profession, and chose the former. Marxism presented essentially the same old Jewish Kabbalistic agenda, but in an updated package. Unlike the Illuminists of 80 years before, Karl Marx had no mystical pretensions whatsoever. He called his ideology dialectical materialism, incorporating a semblance of the Hegelian philosophy, which was the popular mainstream philosophy of that time. One often hears patriotic broadcasters refer vaguely to the Hegelian dialectic as if Hegelianism itself were a tool of conspiracy. In fact, these patriotic broadcasters, sincere though they may be, clearly do not always take the trouble to know what they are talking about. For Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels both stated repeatedly that the Hegelian dialectic, as espoused by Hegel, was not and could not be an instrument of conspiracy. I consider it important to exonerate Hegel of the onus which uneducated patriotic commentators have placed upon him, because it appears as a part of a general knee-jerk tendency to dump on the Germans whenever possible, so as to appease the real perpetrators of the New World Order, the Jews. Since the Germans have striven and sacrificed perhaps more than any other people in fighting the New World Order, I consider this habitual dumping on the Germans a particularly despicable brand of dishonesty and cowardice on the part of certain spokesmen who claim to be opposing the New World Order. In recent years, when the term conservative has been redefined to mean laissez-faire, anything goes, a meaning it never had before, it has become the fashion among the historically myopic to redefine the terms right and left in politics. They claim that the left stands for more government, and that the right stands for less government, and that communism is the extreme of the left, and anarchy the extreme of the right. This conception of the political spectrum is a false one. Historically, Marxism has embraced both communism and anarchism. The anarchists of 100 years ago, such as Alexander Berkman and Red Emma Goldman, were called Reds, and they were indeed Marxists who used the familiar Marxist slogans. On the ostensible premise that society makes men bad, the Marxist ideal is precisely the elimination of all government and of all other social barriers. The same ideal which Adam Weishaupt espoused. The real motive behind this abhorrence of social barriers is simply the Jews' desire to recreate our society in their own image, so that they will have a free hand to engage in power-seeking activities without the barriers that all traditional white societies have imposed on them, so that they can freely engage in all the abhorrent practices which emanate from the Jewish soul and are condoned by their Jewish law book, the Talmud. Perhaps it is clear now why laissez-faire is so widely touted by Jews like Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand. Laissez-faire and Marxism are not the opposites that most of our people assume them to be. Marxism actually goes farther than laissez-faire, advocating a never-never land in the future in which there is no government whatsoever. The captain of the Chicago police, Michael J. Schack, stated in his 1889 book, Anarchy and Anarchists, A History of the Red Terror and the Social Revolution in America and Europe, quote, "It, anarchism, is founded upon the teachings of Karl Marx and his disciples, and it aims directly at the complete destruction of all forms of government and religion. It offers no solution of the problems which will arise when society as we understand it shall disappear, but contents itself with declaring that the duty at hand is tearing down, that the work of building up must come later." Close quote. When one considers that anarchism is, in fact, laissez-faire carried a step farther, it becomes apparent that Marxism and the beloved laissez-faire doctrine of today's so-called conservatives are intimately related, are, in fact, striving toward the same impossible goal, a world without any constraints or conflict, and with plenty for everyone. The salient element in Marxism and laissez-faire is the drive to abolish the constraints and the order of healthy white society. The bribe which these Jewish doctrines offer to their Gentile adherents is a license for self-indulgence. In the name of laissez-faire, our millionaires justify stabbing American working men in the back by importing labor from the non-white world. And under Marxist inspiration, the so-called civil rights movement was organized. Now, it is obvious that the so-called civil rights movement resulted in less freedom for white people. But it has, on the whole, by its destruction of communities and social norms, increased the level of anarchy in the sense of chaos in our society. Furthermore, although it did produce an expansion of government, the really significant thing about the civil rights revolution is that the government has been perverted and is distinctly anti-white and is pernicious in ways that a pro-white government of equal proportions would not be. Indeed, if an equally powerful state had been organized for the purpose of fighting off the enemies of our race, perhaps we would not have been conquered by infiltration as we have been today. Any people which is at war will necessarily have a big government, and that is true whether the enemy be internal or external. The reason why our enemies, the enemies of our race, have built up a big government is that they have marked us, racially conscious white men and women, and really all white people, as enemies in our own land. Big government has been built up to wage war against us. Should we ever gain control of the seat of power, any scruples about using big government against our enemies will be a disaster, a snatching of defeat from the jaws of victory, as it were. In the long term, then, the redefinition of conservative to mean laissez-faire could prove crippling at the very brink of victory. A government in the hands of white patriots will have to be a powerful government if it is to correct all the damage that has been done by the current anti-white regime. So the question of left and right is not a question of more or less government. After all, the original rightists were supporting the big government for its time of Louis XVI, and the original leftists, like Weishaupt, advocated anarchy. But anarchism is always a transitional ideology. Anarchy is a power vacuum, and of course, nature abhors a vacuum. Ultimately, the question is whether we will live in a society ordered according to the character of our own race, or according to the demands of that vastly different Middle Eastern race. This anti-government attitude among patriots is understandable, because in the United States our experiences with big government are almost all bad. Because really big government in the U.S. began with the Jews around Franklin Roosevelt. In the U.S., more government has always meant more racially destructive policies, simply because of the malevolent entity which controls that government. A government that is truly of, by, and for our people, such as that which existed in Germany between 1933 and the triumph of the New World Order in 1945, would not be of that malevolent nature. And under that circumstance, the axiom that big government is bad government would not necessarily apply. The crucial question about government is whether it is run by and for our people, or by and for the enemies of our people. As surely as 19th century liberalism developed into 20th century liberalism, so are today's so-called conservatives and liberals pushing in essentially the same direction, even though one side says less government and the other side pushes for more. Both political parties are universalist, and both see man as a mainly economic entity, and they share these characteristics with Marxism. Therefore, the only valid alternative, the only true antithesis to the New World Order, is a society based on race. Only by establishing a race-based society can America and the civilization of the West survive. Only by establishing a race-based community can we begin to defeat the New World Order. The last time America was altogether culturally healthy was in the 1920s. Internationalism had been repudiated. The First World War had been recognized as a grievous mistake, and America's leaders were committed to keeping America out of any such future catastrophes. Eugenics as a national policy seemed entirely possible for the United States in the 1920s, but the Jews were dead set against it. The last healthy epoch of America's existence was overturned by the Great Depression. The abrupt stock market crash which heralded the Depression did not take the leaders of Jewry by surprise. Some have argued that the Jews used their control of credit through the Federal Reserve System, which they still had in place from the days of their delusional puppet Woodrow Wilson, to engineer that stock market crash. In its July 4, 1995 broadcast, NBC News stated that inside knowledge of the Federal Reserve's plans would be infinitely valuable to any investor. Regardless of whether the Jews caused the crash, or manipulated it, or merely had inside knowledge of it, evidence strongly suggests that Bernard Baruch, an extremely wealthy Jewish speculator who had been one of the Jewish string pullers behind Wilson and virtual economic czar during World War I, Bernard Baruch knew exactly when the crash was coming, since he abruptly pulled all his money out of stocks only a few days before over the protests of his broker. Thus, the leading Jews, through their control and or inside knowledge of the Federal Reserve, were able to buy up American industry for practically nothing. It is an old saw that money is the mother's milk of political campaigns. With their vastly increased share of the American pie, and with a smear campaign, the Jews were able to blame Herbert Hoover for the Depression and replace him with their puppet, Roosevelt, who had run as a conservative but governed as a Marxist socialist and did not let the Constitution get in his way. Roosevelt was also notorious for stocking the executive branch with large numbers of communists and Jews, many of whom remained for decades. When Germany dispossessed the Jews, who had robbed them on a scale far more massive than what occurred in the United States, the Jews wanted revenge. Along the way, the Jews killed several birds with one stone. In order to discredit the eugenics movement, which still had proponents in the United States, the Jews involved this country in what amounted to a war against eugenics. It is said that a war makes any cause sacred, and the Second World War made the cause of doing the Jews' bidding sacred in America. This false religion remains in place to this day. Now we enter the Cold War era. At the end of the Second Fratricidal War in Europe, genuine patriotic Americans like George S. Patton urged that Bolshevism be finished off by military means. Several years later, Senator Joseph R. McCarthy published America's Retreat from Victory, which argued that the reason why the opportunity to destroy Bolshevism had not been grasped was that the American government was controlled by communist sympathizers. This is a demonstrable and obvious fact to anyone who takes the time to investigate the matter. But beyond the mere preservation of the Jews' communist estate, the division of the world into two enemy factions helped the New World Order planners in other ways. By maintaining communism and capitalism as two ostensibly hostile brands of Jewish universalism, the clique of international Jewish bankers and arms merchants and all the rest was able to create wars at leisure. And by financing and selling arms to both sides in various hot wars and in the ongoing Cold War, they were able to vastly increase their wealth and the debt burden of the entire world. Furthermore, the Cold War, with its focus on foreign aggression, diverted attention from subversion at home. The subversion of America advanced most rapidly during the Cold War, especially during the Vietnam War, when patriotic Americans were afraid to complain too loudly, lest the country appear further divided in the face of its foreign foe. At the same time, the Cold War's constant focus on a foreign menace caused people to overlook the treason in their own government. It was the end of the Cold War that allowed America's racial consciousness to spring back to life in time to survey all the damage that treason had wrought in 40 years, not the least of which was the media's gradual brainwashing of the bulk of our people, many of whom had learned to think of America only as the vehicle of a certain brand of universalism, the liberal capitalist brand, which had been represented for 40 years as the only alternative to communism. This liberal capitalist worldview, this phony neoconservatism, was the rationale for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and free trade with China. In a purely materialistic and economic worldview, whether it be laissez-faire or communism, race and nation receive no consideration. What has damaged America more than anything else was the so-called civil rights movement, misnamed insofar as it was not about rights, but about enforcing equality. This movement was planned by the Jews after the Second World War and was carried out at the tactical level by Jewish agitators like the Schwerner and Goodman, who were famously lynched in Mississippi, and by the Jews and fellow travelers who held positions of influence in the media and in universities. At the strategic level, this war against the white race was waged by Gentile stooges like Dwight David Eisenhower, who appointed Earl Warren to the Supreme Court and then said, oops, with a pretended look of surprise, but did not neglect to send paratroopers to Little Rock to enforce the Warren Court's anti-white agenda. Eisenhower, the protege of Bernard Baruch, had also been the first supreme commander of the Soviet-American alliance that called itself the United Nations, even before communist agent Alger Hiss chaired the nominal founding meeting of that organization in San Francisco several years later. Eisenhower's mentor, Baruch, was also a leader of the Jewish community in the Western Hemisphere. So at this point, it is very clear how everything ties together. What threatens America most today is immigration. The United States government has for years been underfunding its border patrol, refusing to take adequate measures to curb the illegal immigration of fast-breeding mestizos. You will recall that non-white immigration was part of the New World Order program, described by F.S. Marvin in 1932. In Canada, this destructive immigration is part of official government policy. Almost 250,000, mostly non-white immigrants, enter Canada legally every year, despite horrendous unemployment among the white population. The U.S. government pursues by subterfuge the very same New World Order policy which the Canadian government pursues openly, and which the British government pursued by bringing Negro laborers into Britain. One would have to be brain dead to believe that the motive for bringing these fast-breeding non-white populations into our homelands is in any way charitable, since any relief afforded to Mexico by emigration will quickly be canceled by population increase. The population of Mexico doubles every 19 years. Current policies will lead to the entire world being overpopulated soon with brown men. As America becomes increasingly non-white, it will also become increasingly unfree. A people united by common blood and common values need few laws and few prisons and few policemen to get along peaceably. Multicultural empires, on the other hand, are not known for their degree of freedom. A non-white America, populated by mulattoes and mestizos, will be easier for our enemies to control and exploit. And whatever white minority remains, if it adheres to the representative process, will be perennially behind the eight ball, always outvoted by racial aliens being manipulated by our enemies. It seems to me that those multiracial constitutional patriots who want us all to pretend that race doesn't matter are leading their adherents in precisely this direction, toward a United States in which the Constitution may be a revered artifact, but an artifact with even less influence than it has today. Friends, we do not have to accept this fate, nor will the fight be as impossible as the purely quantitative worldview predicts. Louis XVI and Tsar Nicholas II died because they lacked the will to resist and didn't even really try. We understand what is happening. A highly motivated and disciplined minority can totally change the course of history. It has happened before. In fact, it has seldom happened in any other way. We have every reason to fight the New World Order and no incentive whatsoever to give up. For the loss of our race means the loss of everything. The struggle itself will make us strong. You have been listening to part 5, the concluding section of Scott Spencer's The History and Significance of the New World Order. This important series will also appear, as do most of our American Dissident Voices broadcasts, in our monthly illustrated newsletter, Free Speech. Free Speech is the monthly publication for supporters of this truth-telling radio program, and a 12-issue, one-year subscription is yours for a donation of only $40 or more. Free speech subscribers not only receive American Dissident Voices articles in permanent, illustrated, printed form every month, but they also receive substantial discounts on books, audio cassettes, and videotapes published by National Vanguard Books, discounts that are normally available only to book dealers. No one is doing what we are doing on the airwaves. Support our efforts and send $40 or more today to National Vanguard Books, Department R, P.O. Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Send $40 or more and ask for a subscription to Free Speech. International listeners may send an international postal money order or international reply coupons. Until next time, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to keep on thinking free.
You've been listening to American Dissident Voices,
a beacon of truth for patriotic Americans and for patriots of our Western civilization around the world.
American Dissident Voices depends upon the voluntary support of its listeners to stay on the air.
Please send the largest gift you can afford today.
Send $1 for a book and tape catalog listing over 300 titles that the controlled media don't want you to see.
Our overseas listeners can substitute 2 international reply coupons for the $1. For a gift of $12 or more, you can receive a high fidelity cassette recording of today's program.
Please give us the call letters of this station, the subject of the program, and today's date.
Write to National Vanguard Books, Department R, P.O. Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.
That's National Vanguard Books, Department R, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.
That's National Vanguard Books, Department R, P.O. Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.
And until the next broadcast, this is Richard Cotton reminding you, as always, freedom is not free, free men are not equal, and equal men are not free.
This program is pre-recorded and comes to you from the United States of America.